From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Germany in April of 1945. The Bergen-Belsen concentration camp was a place of almost unimaginable horrors. Piles of dead bodies were everywhere. Jews were beaten, shot, exhausted, and dying of starvation if the outbreak of disease didn't kill them first. One survivor explained that, thanks to some doctors who were being held in captivity, they learned how to extract the liver from a dead person's body in a desperate attempt to get nutrition and survive. And then, in April 1945, German captors loaded 2,500 Jews onto a train out of the camp on their way to certain execution. These were known often as Nazi death trains. But by April of 1945, Hitler's world was collapsing. The Allies were advancing. After 6 days of travel through Nazi Germany, that train stopped. Some of the prisoners had already died of starvation. Many hadn't. And the rest thought that this was going to be the place of mass execution by German gunners. Instead, they heard shouts and they saw soldiers up the hillside wearing different uniforms. These were Americans, and the Americans had arrived to liberate the train prisoners. The German captors tried to flee, and then a single photograph captures one of the moments that came next. In the foreground, we see a young woman, likely the mother of the little girl we see. She's holding the little girl's hand with a look that shows many emotions. Surprise, perhaps, relief, desperation. Behind her on the hill, another prisoner appears to be both celebrating and greeting the liberating soldiers. The remarkable story here was largely lost until a history teacher in Hudson Falls, New York, learned about it during a class project. While talking to an aging American veteran, the veteran's daughter popped in with a question. "Did you mention the train?" That opened the door to telling this story, to unearthing the photograph that would become one of the enduring images of liberation and victory over Nazi Germany. And the teacher, Matthew Rosell, would go on to research the story as deeply as he could. Who were the survivors from the train? Were some still alive today? Who were the American liberators? Rosell wrote a book called A Train Near Magdeburg, and in the process, he helped unite the liberators and survivors for the first time. You can imagine how powerful and emotional those meetings were. The result was, by many accounts, the largest reunification of Holocaust survivors and soldier liberators in history. The book largely allows the people involved to speak at length on their own. I thought that was one of the great touches of this piece of literature. You're hearing them tell their own story in their own experiences and in their own words. And now the book is being made into a four-part television series due in 2025. But the first part, well, in some ways, it's getting its debut at the Little Theater this Friday at 1 p.m. They would love to see you there on Friday. And this hour, we have a chance to tell this story with a number of people involved. And let me welcome in studio Mike Edwards. Mike Edwards is the director of the four-part documentary, A Train Near Magdeburg. Mike, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Sharon Walsh Saluzzo is with us, a daughter of a liberating soldier. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Welcome on the line to Matthew Rosell, the author of the book that we've been talking about, A Train Near Magdeburg. Matthew, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Evan. It's my pleasure. Hello to Michael, hello to Sharon, and Elizabeth.
Elizabeth Seaman is with us, a Holocaust survivor who is on the line with us. Great to have you, Elizabeth. Thank you for making time.
Well, thank you for including me. I appreciate it.
I don't even really know where to start other than just by asking the author, Matthew Rosell, if you felt overwhelmed when you started to understand and uncover parts of this story and what that was like for you, Matthew.
Well, it was very overwhelming, but let me start by just mentioning that I do have Rochester connections. I am a graduate of SUNY Geneseo, 1983, and it's where I got my undergraduate in history, 1988. I got my master's for teaching, but I couldn't find a job in the Rochester area, so I wound up back here, my hometown, Hudson Falls, New York, in the Capital District region up north. And, yeah, it's been a long time. I interviewed an old soldier. He was 80 at the time, Sharon's dad, Carol Walsh, in 2001, shortly before 9/11. So this has been a 23-year-long journey. I've been working with Mike Edwards for the past 8 years on this film. And, Yeah, so when we talk about the moment I felt overwhelmed, it's been a long road, and it's been very gradual, but it was probably when I got an email from a woman in Australia who had been a seven-year-old girl on that train. She was a grandmother now, and this is going back to 2006. I realized that these people were out there, and now they're reaching out to find some closure, and they were able to reunite with their liberating soldiers, and that was a pretty overwhelming moment.
I'm going to ask all of the guests to weigh in just at the outset with what this story, you know, what Matthew's work has meant, and frankly, how important this story is. And I should start with Elizabeth. Elizabeth, did you ever think a story like this would be turned into a book and a television series and brought to our consciousness in this way?
No, certainly not, because most of the world seemed to have forgotten about this time and what was happening in World War II, especially in that area where we were, by Bergen-Belsen and that part of Germany. And so it was a happy surprise to find out what Matt was doing and the reunions we had that I went to, also both of those of the 39th Infantry Division and also at Hudson Falls, and to meet with others, and especially others who'd been on the train at the same time and were similar age, and whom I've seen since then again. And but for Matt to turn this into the book and now the television series is really pretty amazing and necessary at a time when there seems to be, again, so much negative action and thinking in regard to people of different beliefs and races and so on. So it's a timely event.
Sharon, what did you make of the story, and when did you really understand what your dad had done? I mean, what I don't know about you is, was it the book? Is this the kind of thing that got talked about often when you were growing up? Tell me about that.
Dad didn't talk about this much when we were growing up, and it was probably in the 1990s when he and Dr. George Gross were talking together a lot. Dr. Gross was putting together his memoirs, and he would call my father every so often and say, "Is this the way you remember it? This is the way I remember it." And so they'd add kind of details to each other. And one day our dad just, I think we were there having dinner, and he started telling us the story about the train. So that was the first that we had really heard the story. And then, of course, Matt's interview with him, it was my sister who spoke up and said, after a two-hour interview, "Did you tell him about the train, Dad?" And that was just an amazing time. It was an amazing thing that Matt sat back down, put his equipment all back up, set it all up again, and started to record the story. The magnitude of it, I think, probably really hit at the reunion in 2009 that I attended. Mm. And there were soldiers and survivors and laughter and tears and hugs, incredible stories of bravery from all of them. But just to see this closure, this ability to, for the soldiers to see what happened to all of these people. How did their lives turn out? And to see that there were doctors and engineers, professors, mothers who raised beautiful children and who grew up to be doctors and engineers. And I think it gave them a sense of peace. And I think for the survivors as well, because so many of them said, "I've been looking for you my whole life, and now I have a name and a face to go with this." So I would say that for me, that was probably the moment.
Mike, as the director of this four-part documentary, it's a big responsibility to tell this story, and a great wealth of material now that these connections have been made. Tell us a little bit about the timeline for when we can actually see this. We're going to, again, part one, Friday, 1 p.m. at the Little Theater. Mike would like everyone who's hearing my voice to be there. But beyond that, tell me a little bit through the timeline and then what you hope that this documentary series can accomplish.
So where we're at right now, we finished episode one. We screened that on May 8th of this year. In order for us to go into the distribution process, we needed something to be made. So the goal was to make episode one. Currently, we're in the process of getting episode two up on its feet. And we're hoping to complete the entire series, I would say probably late spring, early summer next year. And hopefully it'll be released summer and fall of next year. You know, our whole goal with this entire project is education. You know, you can be a liberator too. You know, we're hoping that people that hear this story and listen to it, it touches people. I mean, every time I share the story, we were just speaking at lunch earlier, it just grips people. And, you know, for people that may have their own moments of life that they're trying to decide, you know, what should I do? It's about caring for others. And these guys stopped. They didn't have to stop, but they did. And these people were in a situation by no fault of their own, but they stopped and they cared about them. And it had generational impact. And we're hoping that people who see this story will learn about it and be inspired to do the same thing in their own life.
I am, in watching the trailer for the first part of the four-part series, Matthew, I thought about the ways that war not only brings out possibly the worst of humanity, but it robs families and entire generations. And I don't remember the number, 50,000 or 25,000. There's something you've tried to kind of measure how many families and future generations were saved and allowed to thrive because of the actions that happened to free the prisoners of this train in 1945. And it made me think of a book written by my uncle, who wrote a book about his experiences, not only in Vietnam, but he went back 40 years later to kind of retrace his steps. But then he came back to the United States and thought, you know, three close friends died alongside me. I'm going to go find their families 40 years later and find out how those deaths affected them. And it was profound. You can't measure something like that. Well, then on the flip side, when you liberate, how many lives do we have now on this world? Because of thousands, right?
Yeah, we did a kind of a estimate, and the estimate that we came up with was 40 to 50,000.
Amazing.
And that's probably a conservative number. So yeah, that one action, like I said, had just generational impact.
Well, the book is A Train Near Magdeburg. Listeners, at the very least, just when you can safely do it, just Google A Train Near Magdeburg. You're going to see the cover. Maybe that's a photograph you've seen by now. Maybe you have not. It is such a powerful image. And Matthew, do you remember when you first laid eyes on that image?
Yeah. I'll go back to the interview with Judge Walsh. He was a retired New York State Supreme Court justice. We talked for 2 hours, and he told me tales of terror, boredom. He told me funny stories. He told me, you know, about being very close to death himself. He was 24 years old in 1945. And he and another tank commander who Sharon already mentioned, George Gross, those were the two guys in two separate tanks who were called out of the tank column to investigate this train on April 13th, 1945, you know, near the Elbe River as Nazi Germany was collapsing. And it was Walsh who said, you need to talk to George Gross because he had a camera that day. And Gross took 10 or 11 photographs, but he also had a photograph that their major took. And their major was Major Clarence Benjamin of the 743rd Tank Battalion. He was the one who led the two tanks, and he's in a Jeep with a driver. And the moment of liberation is what you're talking about, that famous photograph that he took himself, where I picture him standing up in the Jeep that's now stopped. The tanks are rolling up behind him. And these people milling about the train, this is the moment that they realize they've been saved. the Germans had ordered them out of the train probably about an hour before, the men and the boys. They set up machine gun nests, and they were going to kill them. But they knew the Americans were in the vicinity. So when the tanks clanked up, and you look at that photograph, you can see the mother overjoyed, the little daughter clutching her mom's hand. She's staring in behind the she's not looking directly at the lens. She has a terrified expression on her face, and I speculate she sees these two tanks rolling up, and she doesn't know what's going on. Yeah. So it was Gross who gave me the photographs, and he was the one, probably about 6 months after the interview, gave me permission to put them on the Hudson Falls High School webpage that I created for this. And 4 years went by, and that's when I heard from the grandmother in Australia. And then it was just a cascade of people who came to me one way or another and said, I was there too. And that's where the genesis for the reunions came about. They're all done. The first ones were done at the high school and were witnessed by students and teachers. And it was, like Mike said, it was a very educational event. It was very powerful, like Sharon said. And it was just amazing. But it hasn't stopped, Evan. It's been going on now for 23 years.
It's amazing.
And we've located close to 300 survivors, and we've orchestrated 11 reunions, of which Elizabeth has been to many, on three continents, including Israel. And I can tell you, when Mike talks about those numbers of people alive today because of what those soldiers did, I was in a room with 500 of them in Israel when they met one of their liberators, Frank Towers, the man who was charged after the tank commanders left the scene. Frank was charged, 30th Infantry Division, with getting them out of harm's way and seeing that they were taken care of. So, yeah, very powerful.
Elizabeth, let me ask you a little bit about memory. You know, I have talked to many veterans who have very different both ideas about what they want to talk about and can talk about, and also what they can remember and don't remember. And sometimes trauma, it burns very viscerally into our memory, certain events, and sometimes trauma makes our memory almost inaccessible. And for you, what do you remember most about that time?
What I remember is that actually before the tanks and the Jeep came, that I had, because the train was stopped, that I had gotten out of the train, and it was a beautiful spring day. It was like a grassy hillside with wildflowers, and this was just amazing because all I could think of was where we had been in Bergen-Belsen. I just had images of gray and black, and except that the buildings were green, which later on was verified for me was the case. But here was all this beauty. But then the German soldiers came and said, get back in the train. And that was sad. And I wasn't actually aware when the Americans came. And so I wish I had been, but I have had the pleasure of meeting and speaking with both Carol Walsh and George Gross. I went down to San Diego one day with a friend to meet with him, and that was lovely. And then he and his son also came up to Northern California one time, and we had lunch together. So the actual day, time of that liberation, I can't say that I was aware of, but certainly of that day and what a beautiful spring day it was. And that afterwards, after the liberation, then my mother and I were taken to a field hospital at Hillersleben, because my mother was extremely ill and took several months to recover. So that's kind of my memory of that particular time.
Elizabeth, I mean, I don't want to, I want to ask you this in a way just to help listeners really understand the plight of the people on that train. In the book, you know, and I'll say again, I think Matthew does a beautiful job of allowing many different people just to share their experiences and their recollections at length, and you understand what they were seeing versus maybe what a Jewish passenger or a captor, a person in captivity was experiencing. A lot of different angles here, but almost everybody agrees, at least the adults who, people who were adults at the time, it was jarring to see the conditions of the people on that train, that they were skeletal, that they were barely human, that they were barely alive. And, you know, as someone younger, do you remember that? Do you remember any sense of that?
Yes, I do. And, you know, most of the people were in cattle cars and they had, you know, they barely could fit with each other there. And my mother and I, fortunately, were in one of the passenger cars, but they were just as crowded. And of course, there were no sanitary facilities. I think maybe there was some kind of a bucket or something at one end of the train car. And food, I think also, I don't know what we ate during those days, and if anything. And I remember this terrible crowdedness and awful smell. Just, you know, the feeling still comes back of that, just everybody pushed together and pretty awful.
Matthew, can you describe for listeners as well some of the kinds of stories that you were collecting from, especially from the liberators who were appalled at what they were seeing, but, you know, obviously very, very glad to be on the scene to help those, the poor souls who were, many of whom were close to death. Some had, some of the 2,500 did not make it to liberation. Some died of starvation, literally, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was traumatic. Here you have young guys, let's face it, the average GI by this point in the war was about 19 or 20 years old. So Walsh, being 24, he was an old man. And but he had been through 10 months of combat, and he said, Matt, we were fugitives from the law of averages, meaning they were still intact when they crossed the Rhine River. They landed about a month after D-Day in Normandy. This would be July 44. They fought through the first city that was taken, German city, at the Battle of Aachen in October, this time of the year, 80 years ago this month. Horrific battles. Saw a lot of friends killed. And then they had to come back across the Siegfried Line when the Battle of the Bulge happened in early December, which went on again for another two or three months in horrific freezing conditions in the wintertime. So it just went on and on and on. And this is what Walsh told me. He said, Nah, I couldn't even tell you what my mother looked like by the time we crossed the Rhine River. And Gross said the same thing. The third week of March 1945, these guys are exhausted. They're going for 18 hours a day now. There's more daylight, but the Germans, they seem to be on the run. But they're putting up good resistance in every German town that they went through. So they had to be very cautious when they approached this train. And they were just exhausted. So I can remember Walsh told me, he remembers peering into one of the boxcars and just seeing people in all sorts of states of emaciation. They're covered with lice. This is something the survivors will tell you about. They couldn't believe that these GIs didn't recoil as much as they might have, you know? They were just in total shock at the state of these poor survivors. And, you know, looking at it from the survivor's perspective, a lot of them were in a state of shock too, you know?
Yeah.
Many of them said to me later that the 13th of April was their second birthday. It was the day that they were reborn. So to meet these gentlemen 62, 65 years later in a much greater setting where they could, you know, the children and grandchildren, second generation, can meet their counterparts who were delivering soldiers. Just profoundly, extraordinarily emotional moments, as you can imagine. And but yeah, going back to the trauma and the shock, and when we talk about this story of the 2,500 people who were on the train, who were liberated and saved, we have to remember that probably 10% of them died after liberation. I can remember one survivor telling me the story of her grandfather, very religious man, And she said, Matt, he died with a smile on his face because he was liberated. You know, a few days after liberation, they were so sick. And they buried him. They buried him, I think, in Hillersleben.
Sharon, you must be very proud of your dad.
Proud is an interesting word. You know, Dad didn't volunteer for that. He was chosen. He and George Gross's tanks were told this is what they were going to do. And my father never thought of himself as a hero, nor did Dr. Gross. They would settle on the word witness. And I think that that is a word that is truly important to think of them as being witnesses to what occurred at that time. If I may, I have a letter that my dad wrote to one of the survivors, Steve Berry. And I think it really sums up how my father felt about this whole incident.
Beautiful.
Steve Berry was one of the first survivors to respond to Matt with an email. There's a photo of him on the day of liberation. He was a young man sitting on the edge of the open boxcar, too weak to walk. Steve learned about my dad from Matt Roselle and visited him and my mother at their home in Florida. Steve and my father often spoke on the phone, and my dad wrote a letter to Steve, which he then donated to the U.S. Holocaust Museum. And the letter states in part, "You are always expressing gratitude to me, to the 743rd Tank Battalion, and the 30th Infantry Division. But I don't believe that gratitude is deserved because we were doing what we and the whole world should have been doing, rescuing and protecting innocent people from being killed, murdered by vicious criminals. You don't owe us, we owe you. We can never repay you and the Jewish people of Europe what was stolen from you. Your homes, your possessions, your businesses, your money, your art, your family life, your families, your childhood, your dreams, and above all, your lives. The least that I and the other Americans could do was to eliminate such people as the Nazis and their armies." My father goes on, but concludes his letter with this: "However, one good thing did come out of all of this horror. We did get to meet, and we gained something wonderful: friendship. We have come to know each other. We have become friends. I am proud to call you my friend. And besides, I love your sense of humor."
First of all, thank you for sharing that. And as someone who has not ever been asked to do what your father was asked to do, I think I would just add that I think those actions are heroic. Well, I understand that they were part of the duty. They were part of the charge. They were part of the mission. But they are nonetheless essential and heroic. And I am proud as an American to know that Americans did things like that.
Yes.
That is an amazing, amazing story. And, you know, Mike is not along with us. There are times, Mike, that I think, you know, I read a lot of sort of political theory and, you know, history of nations. And I think that sometimes the farther away we get and the further away in time we get from existential conflict, we sort of lose a sense of the stakes of the value of peace and maintaining a world order and, you know, maybe taking for granted people like Carol Red Walsh and others. That's how I feel. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I do. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're doing the film, is to teach history. People need to be taught history, to be able to learn from it, to be able to reflect on it. You know, Matt's blog, the name of Matt's Roselle's blog, is Teaching History Matters. And I think because he was willing to teach it, and because we're willing to, you know, teach it to others through this film, I'm hoping that, you know, it will, like I said, inspire others to action and to do the right things.
Let me just reset things for listeners who may be joining the program without hearing it from the top. We're talking about, the stories and the historical lessons from a book. I mean, the book tells the story of what happened with the liberation of roughly 2,500 Jewish people who were on a Nazi death train. That's a good way to describe it. They were going to be executed. They had been held at the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp, and they thought that they were on their way to die. Well, American forces liberated that train in April of 1945 in Germany. And the book from Matthew Rosell is called A Train Near Magdeburg, A Teacher's Journey into the Holocaust and the Reuniting of the Survivors and Liberators 70 Years On. The book has been available for a number of years now. It is, my son will read it. It's essential. It's so well done. And now, thanks to Mike Edwards and others, there's going to be a four-part documentary series of A Train Near Magdeburg, debuting next year sometime. But the first part of that series is ready for you to see it. And you can see it on Friday of this week, 1 p.m. on Friday at the Little Theater. And they really would appreciate you being there. The Little is doing what they do. They bring great content to you, great discussions afterwards, and an excellent opportunity to learn and understand this story more. So Matthew Rosell, the author of A Train Near Magdeburg, is with us. Mike Edwards is the director of the documentary series A Train Near Magdeburg. Mike is with us. Sharon Walsh Saluzzo is the daughter of a liberating soldier, who some of whose account you'll find in this book. Elizabeth Seaman is a Holocaust survivor, telling the experience of what it was like, from the perspective of a child on that train. And what we're going to do in a moment, we're going to break in our second half hour. You know, Elizabeth's career is so interesting. We talk about the lives that were saved. Elizabeth's career in conflict mediation, I feel like the world needs that now. And we're going to talk to Elizabeth about that coming up. But a couple other points before we go to break. And I want to ask Matthew, the author of this book. Matthew, for me as a reader, you know, I want to say that it is never easy to read about the concentration camps. It should always, always appall us. But what was new to me was finding out that the Pattons of the world, that literally the war leadership of the United States and the Allies, they would, you know, in the weeks and months after the liberation of this train and when the war was ending, they would go to these sites like Bergen-Belsen and be literally physically ill. They were extremely moved, and maybe knew about it, or some soldiers might have known what they were fighting for. Some might not have known just how extreme things had become with the Holocaust. That, to me, was a really powerful point about a war where there's so much chaos and war, but then when the leadership is kind of going in and seeing just what the conditions were, we're truly horrified. And I guess I just want to ask you why you think it's important for people to understand that in that war, it's not like every person who wore a uniform knew exactly what was going on, knew that there were trains or even concentration camps. A lot of the fog of the war was lifting, and people were truly, truly devastated to see how terrible it had been, weren't they?
Yeah. I mean, our GIs, again, they're young men, and they're fighting, and they had heard in the Stars and Stripes newspaper, they had heard stories, okay? But when they're crossing over into Germany in early April 1945, that's when they began to overrun these camps. And this train was from the camp Bergen-Belsen, which the British actually liberated 2 days after the train itself was freed by the Americans. They liberated on the 15th of April. Bergen-Belsen being in the northwest of Germany. But on April 12th, which would have been the day before the train was liberated, in central Germany, that's when a subcamp of Buchenwald, another notorious camp called Ohrdruf, that was liberated, I think it was by the American 11th Armored Division. And on the 12th is when Eisenhower, Patton, Omar Bradley, stepped into the camp, and had their own tour. Patton went behind one of the shacks, if you could call, you know, the barracks there, and he threw up. He got physically ill, old blood and guts himself. He couldn't take what he saw. And it was Eisenhower who said, look, I want congressmen here. I want reporters from all over the world. I want the world to see what's going on here, because someday some fool is going to say this never happened. And if you go to the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., our nation's leading institution for the remembrance of the Holocaust, you'll see Eisenhower's words inscribed on the wall, the exterior wall of the museum. So he was very present in his thinking here, thinking very far ahead. And yeah, as time goes on, you realize as you study the Holocaust, which I did, I became a teacher fellow at that museum. I studied at the authentic sites throughout Europe, the death camps. I went on tours with educators who were experts. I studied at Yad Vashem, Israel's Holocaust Authority. And the more you learn about this cataclysmic event in the history of the world, the greatest crime in the history of the world, as far as I'm concerned, the more you realize you don't really know. And there is so much more to uncover. It's very difficult. I liken it to going into a room where there's 12 doors, and every single door that you open, you're stepping into a whole other world with another 12 doors to go through. And I guess my point is, this is an important story on many levels. But the other thing to point out is, our GIs, they didn't believe this when they heard it and read about it in the Stars and Stripes. They thought that this is something to make us fight harder, you know? Now the GI knows what he's fighting for. He might not have known it all along, but he certainly knows what we're fighting against now. This is what Eisenhower said on April 12th, and it was true. And he wanted the world to know, and the world must know. And that's why Mike and I are working on this film.
How remarkable that some of those men knew that there might come a time when the world would deny that this happened, and felt, as hard as it was, they had to document it.
Precious. I'm going to add one more quick thing. And I can remember, you know, we had survivors. Dr. Peter Lantos came up to high school. He was a six-year-old boy from Hungary who was on the train. And I remember one of the students said, how could people deny this? You know, we had the survivors up on the stage. We had the liberators telling what they saw. And the kids are incredulous. You know, talk about Holocaust denial. I've been attacked. I got attacked after the book came out. Mike and I are going to be attacked when this film comes out. There's no question about it. But I remember Lantos's answer to this kid, and he said, I'll tell you what, it's such an incredible thing, meaning, can you even imagine, how do you even go about killing 6 million Jewish people, you know, two-thirds of the population? How does it happen in 3.5 years? How does it happen? And he said, It's so overwhelming. This is why we have to study it, because it did happen. You know, you're killing 25,000 people a day in the summer of 1944 at Auschwitz. There's a plan there. There's a methodology. Somebody's driving the train, you know. And how many Jews did Hitler kill with his own hands?
Well,
right? None.
We have to take our only break of the hour. The book is A Train Near Magdeburg. The film, the documentary series, is called A Train Near Magdeburg, and we are right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the next Connections, in our first hour, two candidates for office joining us. They're both running for re-election, and we will divide it up. Senator Jeremy Cooney and Assemblymember Jen Lunsford join us. In our second hour, Teen Empowerment is talking about their new space and how the organization's teens are helping their peers navigate issues like nihilism and violence. Talk with you Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Elizabeth Seaman is on the line with us, one of the survivors of that train near Magdeburg that held 2,500 Jewish people who were going to be murdered, maybe within minutes or hours that day, when American forces liberated that train in April of 1945. And Elizabeth has gone on to have a fascinating career of her own. Elizabeth, can you tell us about some of the work that you've done over the years, first of all, generally speaking?
Yes, I will, but I did want to come back to something, too, Matt had said, and that is about history and education, because it is great to see now that at the Bergen-Belsen Memorial, it's all about education, and it's they created great programs that go out into the schools, and students come there. And last time I was there at the last reunion they had about 2.5 years ago, I was even asked on the spot if I would go and talk to some high school students there, you know, with no preparation or anything. But I said, yes, I would. And the kids are taking these things in. And there's much going on throughout Germany to educate people there. And I'm very glad that they are doing that. Yes, and back to my own career.
Yeah.
After the war, somehow, even as a child, peace was very important to me. And after I pretty much raised my family of four kids, now I even have four great-grandkids, I learned about mediation. I had not heard of this before. And I thought, oh, that sounds like something good. So I took training. I became a mediator. I was a mediator for 40 years, for 30 years, had my own business. And we not only help people to resolve their differences with each other, but we realized that even though they resolved their differences, they had no idea how to replicate that. So then we started the education part, which was workshops and trainings to help people have the skills to prevent and to manage conflict on their own. And we felt that that was, it's a small drop in the bucket, but at least it's somewhat helpful. And then we produced books also on the subject of conflict resolution. And so more people could gain the skills for themselves. Because if we're going to have peace worldwide, it's got to start one-on-one. And being able to talk with people with whom we have differences, whether it's family relationships or it's political differences or whatever it is that divides people, if they can learn to talk with each other, which it starts with listening to each other, listening for deeper understanding and not jumping on and reaching conclusions based on assumptions, which may be totally incorrect, that then we're making a start. So listening, and even though I'm retired, still helping where I live and with others to really listen to each other in depth and try to understand each other. Because if we can do that, we still may not agree with the other person. We may not like what they're saying, but at least we understand how they got to where they are. And I feel that that's pretty important.
Well, Elizabeth, to say nothing of international events, I would just focus on how sometimes it feels in this country to disagree with a neighbor or to drive down a street to see political signs that for a candidate that you're not voting for, and how sometimes visceral that feels. And to sometimes hear political leaders use words like vermin and, you know, enemy within. And, you know, how do we get past this point of seeing people who are voting differently as, you know, less than human, not worthy of respect for starters, and much, much worse? What do we do with this, Elizabeth?
Well, to me, it is realizing we all come from the same creator. And we are all made equally good, but then what we do with that in our lives differs, and we're not necessarily listening to and following our better selves. And so it's important that as individuals, we try to honor the better person that's inside each one and try to help draw that out so that we can understand better. And we'll still differ. There's going to be differences, and we don't want to all be the same. But we can still value the differences and accept that they are there. At the same time, perhaps trying to, in a caring and logical way, to persuade others maybe of our view, but let them also have the chance to try to persuade us of theirs. At least we're in dialogue then. And so long as we're in dialogue, we're not fighting.
Can I ask Sharon Walsh Saluza, who's the daughter of a liberating soldier and been telling her family's remarkable story this hour, this is going to be a little clumsy, but we are certainly seeing, we are not seeing the end of anti-Semitism, unfortunately. And I am deeply sad about that. Do you feel despair about that? Do you feel hope in any sense that the world will be a healthier place at some point?
I believe in the goodness of people, and I think that light is better than dark. And if we share this story, as I said, the GIs thought of themselves as witnesses. We are the next generation of witnesses. We are the people to bring this story and stories like this forward and lead into discussions. As Elizabeth said, nothing really gets accomplished permanently by war, but through discussions, through understanding one another and listening to one another. And the listening part is an extraordinary part of that. I guess I have hope that we will have people who will look upon this, look upon the story that we are unfolding in a train near Magdeburg, and use that as a starting point to say, look what happened here. Why did this happen? How can we prevent that from happening again? And how do we bring people together who have been enemies for ages? And at least get that kind of dialogue going.
I think when we talk about that distance in history of time and space, it's easy to think, well, that was the 1940s. It is easy to convince yourself that never again will be never again.
But we're seeing that is not true.
We have to be very careful.
And I know that several of the survivors are heartbroken over what has happened now that, you know, the saying, never again, is fading, and I think we owe them certainly to do all that we can so that it is never again.
Mike Edwards, as the director of this four-part documentary, we're getting ready to wrap up in a minute here, so I want to just tell listeners, you can meet Mike Friday at 1 o'clock at the Little Theater. It is part one of the four-part documentary, A Train Near Magdeburg. Now, the film that you'll see at 1 o'clock at the Little on Friday is about 47 minutes long. It'll be followed by a Q&A with Mike, the director, and there's a lot of things that they could talk about there. What do you hope kind of comes out of events like this? What are you looking forward to on Friday?
I think I'm just looking forward to continuing to tell the story. You know, the story, as I said before, when we tell it, it resonates with people. It affects people. I've watched it time and time again. And I'm hoping, as Sharon said, that it'll change people's lives, that it will affect people viscerally, intellectually, emotionally, because we all have choices every day that we face to care or not. And I'm hoping, as I've said before, I'm just hoping that, you know, one of the survivors of the train when we were in Israel, I had forgotten my backpack when we were interviewing him. And I had to go back and fetch my backpack. And as I was walking out with my backpack, he said, "Michael, come here. Come here." And we've been on this journey to get this film made for nearly 10 years. And it's been hard, but it's been full of joy. And he stood up from his chair and he put his arms around me. And he said, "Michael, don't ever quit. Don't ever quit." And I made a promise to the, you know, to the liberators. I made a promise to the survivors to not quit and to make sure this story gets told. And so it's just a joy every time we get a chance to tell it, just to see what people's reaction to it. And like I said, hopefully it'll change their life.
The book and the documentary series have the same name, A Train Near Magdeburg. You can find the book now. You can see the first part of this documentary series on Friday at 1 p.m. at the Little Theater. And let me just say to our guests, for taking the time here and telling these stories, often difficult stories, the world is going to be grateful for it. We are certainly better for understanding because of the work that you've done. Mike Edwards, director of this series, thank you for this. Let's stay in touch. So maybe we'll talk to you next year when you're...
That'd be great.
...farther down the road.
We'd love to be back.
Thank you, Mike. Sharon Walsh Saluzzo, thank you for talking about your dad and telling your family story and sharing your experience as well. It's been great having you here.
Thank you, Evan. Thank you for sharing the story with your listeners.
You got it. Elizabeth Seaman, who is one of the survivors of that train and telling this story now and really spending decades doing great work, helping bring people closer together. Elizabeth, an honor to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Evan. It's been a pleasure, and a pleasure to hear from all of you, and I hope this goes far and wide.
You got it. And Matt Rozell, author of the book, A Train Near Magdeburg. Hey, just keep doing this work, Matt. Amazing stuff. Thank you.
Thanks, Evan, for reading, and thanks for being part of our journey.
You got it. From all of us at Connections, thank you for listening. We are back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.